get to be together. So many friends, you know, friends from Seattle and Bellingham, both sanghas well represented. Well, thanks, Connie. And friends from further away, Portland, California, old children of friends, you know, grown up children of friends. So it just goes on, you know. So our theme being effort, I just want to right away appreciate that we're all making an effort to be here. Oh, more friends back there. There's lots of other things we could have been doing today. And yet we made an effort to be here. And whether we're staying for the day or the weekend or just the hour, we'll continue to make an effort, right? The effort to be alive, the effort to be ourself, or try not to be ourself, depending on what's going on. The effort to help others. The effort to continue. But first, I think we better acknowledge the difficult events in the world. Another shooting. Horrible. And I realized I almost said, when I was writing this, I almost wrote down senseless shooting. Because it certainly looks senseless from here, doesn't it? An action that we can't really make any sense of. That a couple would stockpile weapons and make a plan, you know, to kill a bunch of people, coworkers, people on the street, people in a concert hall, people in a synagogue, and probably it's only a matter of time before people in a zendo are shot. It's a matter of time. So it seems so senseless and horrible. But we also know that actually people do things that make sense to them. That seem like the right thing to do in the moment or under the circumstances, given what they're thinking and feeling. And that's how people are. They were all that way. Subjectively, at least, except in some extreme cases, you know, with mental illness, everybody, or maybe we're all somewhat mentally ill anyway, but everybody does what makes sense. So somehow what happened in San Bernardino made sense to that couple. But it doesn't make sense to us. And maybe this is a blessing, that it doesn't make sense to us. That it will never make sense to us, we hope. But it's still horrible. So many shootings, the world seems to be coming apart at the seams. It's getting hard to keep track, right? Was the last one Colorado Springs, or this other place in Colorado, the theater? Or was it a college in Oregon, or was it an elementary school, a post office? What a state of affairs. And yet, here's some interesting other news from the New York Times a little while ago. A survey found that 2/3 of Americans believe that the portion of the world population living in extreme poverty has probably doubled in the last 20 years. And another 29% of Americans in this survey believed that the proportion of people in extreme poverty has remained basically the same. So that's 95% of Americans who are completely wrong. In fact, it turns out, the proportion of the world's population living in extreme poverty hasn't doubled, hasn't remained the same in the last 20 years, Actually, it's reduced by half. Depending on how you measure extreme poverty, it's either a dollar a day or a dollar 25 a day, you know, two different standards. This article says that the percentage of people has fallen from about 35% of the world's population in 1993 to 14% of the world's population in 2011, living in extreme poverty. So how does this affect the world when 95% of Americans are completely wrong about the way things are going in the world, at least in this particular way? And it's also, this is a journalist writing, it was an op-ed piece, and the journalist in it writes, and this also reflects a complete flaw in the way we journalists do our work, you know. We only report on the disasters. In 1990, more than 12 million children died before the age of 5. And this toll has dropped by half also. More kids than ever are becoming educated, especially girls. In the 1980s, only half of girls in developing countries completed elementary school, and now 80% do. So the most important thing going on in the world today is something that we never talk about, that we don't believe is happening, a rapid decline in poverty, illiteracy, and disease. Granted that things are still pretty bad, he says. 16,000 children still die unnecessarily every day. He writes, it's maddening in my travels to watch these children dying simply because they were born in the wrong place at the wrong time. But, he says, one reason for our complacency about the world is the feeling that poverty is inevitable and getting worse, and that is simply not true. That the world's best kept secret, he says, is that we live at a historic moment, a historic inflection point when extreme poverty is retreating rapidly. And the United Nations recently put together a new plan that they hope will lead to essentially the complete elimination of extreme poverty by 2030. The goals are historic, but current evidence suggests that this is actually possible. This can be done. And there have been recently some other statistics about safety, more relevant to, directly relevant, I guess, to our school shooting horror, that despite the horrible things that are going on in the world that we're aware of, the complete disaster of Syria, you know, imagine living in one of those cities in Syria, the rise of ISIS, all these horrible shootings, still on the whole, much as the world is less impoverished than it ever has been, the world is safer than it ever has been. Statistics suggest really strongly that it's the least, you know, this is the safest time in history. You're the least likely to die young from violence or malnutrition or other things that are avoidable. But you know, it's funny because it's really hard for our mind to think in terms of statistics and probabilities. The concrete is what the mind holds so strongly. And of course, statistics are no comfort to the families of the 14 people who died on Wednesday in San Bernardino, just thought they were going to a work party. But I think it's important to see if we can practice holding the horror in this broader concept, this broader reality, that actually there's less suffering, not more, overall, even if there's still far too much. And this doesn't make us complacent, it just spurs us on. It makes us realize what we do really matters, the efforts we make really matter, and we can be part of a solution. Of course, then, you know, your mind's saying, well, what about global warming? That's another talk. I rode my bike today, anyway. So anyway, I thought we can't really sort of just blithely talk about religion without recognizing the things that are happening, right? So let's return to the theme of effort, which is, I suppose, a kind of effort, the effort to turn towards both the difficult things and the good things that are happening. So effort's been very much in my mind and in my attention these last weeks, because it takes a fair amount of effort to put on these retreats. And I want to especially thank people who did a lot of effort. A lot of people are involved, including everybody in this room, but especially Connie and Kate and Bob Rose and probably other people who I should also name too. So thank you to all of you wonderful people for all your effort. It's a lot of work to put on this retreats, and I think even though we're reasonably skillful about how we organize it, of course there's always room for improvement, and we've done this a lot of times, and we have systems and written descriptions of things and schedules and plans, still it's not so easy. Because the people who are doing the work, for good and ill, are people. And people have all kinds of ways of going about effort, don't we? Sometimes the effort of putting on retreat seems joyful and easy, other times it seems difficult and burdensome. And it's really hard to tell, you know, why that is. Are there particular tasks involved in putting on a retreat, like, particularly difficult? Are some of them easier than others? Is it the task itself? Is it the way we think about the task that makes it easy or difficult? Is it the way we think about the near future? Like, what's going to happen on Thursday night? All these people are going to arrive, you know, and are we going to be ready? So it's a tricky thing, and the harder we think about it, the crazier we get. And it's not right to just not worry about it either, right? And just like blow it off. Oh, it'll work out, you know. They're nice people. They'll understand, you know, if we're not too organized. So that's not right either. So how do you do it? And what do we even mean when we say something's hard? Like, what does that actually mean? Does it mean it has a certain kind of weight in the mind? Is it associated with some mental states? Worry, anger, fear? What does it mean when something's easy? So I was thinking a great advantage of Sesshin, of sitting down and being quiet for a while, is we can watch our mind, you know, watch some of the patterns that are so automatic in us so much of the time when we're running around being busy, and start to discern a little bit, like, well, what is it about effort? You know, what is it in me that supports easeful effort, that supports angry effort, that supports fearful effort? How does it feel in the body? How does it go in the mind? Is the hardness or the difficulty or the ease baked into the task and the situation? Is it my fault? Is it somebody else's fault? I mean, who knows, you know? But I think it's a very complicated and interesting field of study for us, and very important to really reflect on what contributes when there's a flavor of suffering in our effort. What is that? The Buddha was quite clear about the root cause of suffering, wasn't he? Grasping, he said, causes suffering. Aversion causes suffering. The many different ways, small and large, subtle and blatant, that we want things to be a little different from the way they are. We want ourselves to be a little different from the way we are. And goodness knows, we sure want other people to be a little different from the way they are. And so the Buddha included the idea of right effort in his eightfold plan for working on this quality of suffering that we bring to our experience. Right effort. And he gave many teachings on that. And then Buddhist practitioners through the ages have found ways to practice with this. What's a sustainable effort? And in Bellingham, we've particularly lately been thinking about, how did this get here? You know, how did this happen that we're sitting here in a Soto Zen, Zendo? Some of us wearing Tang Dynasty Chinese clothing. Most of us having grown up like in American suburbs. You know, how did this happen? How is this possible? So we've been thinking particularly about the pioneering students and teachers who contributed to establishing this way of practice. in America, in North America, in Bellingham, in Seattle, Canada, Mexico. And we've been exploring their stories, and in our practice period this winter, we're going to particularly explore some of their teachings. And lately, I've been thinking about one Zen priest who came to America early on, very early in the 20th century, named Nyogen Sensaki. And so I want to read you his story, the story of a young Japanese man, Zen Buddhist priest and practitioner, who somehow ended up a part of our path, contributed in some way to this being here today. And I was thinking about the effort of giving a talk, and I realized that, yeah, for sure, the suffering involved in giving a talk that happens right before giving the talk is like usually comes in the form of some kind of worry, right? You worry, are you going to say the right thing? You know, is it the right topic? Are you the right person? Do you deserve to be in the seat or whatever, right? So I was just curious, like, well, what was my worry today? And my worry today is that the talk's going to be way too long. So anyway, just want you to know that. I don't know if that's true or not because it's just a worry, you know. But there's a little bit to the story of Nyogen Sensaki, but I think it's worth spending some time on. Nyogen Sensaki came to America in 1905 with his teacher, Soyen Shaku. And we could do a whole talk on Soyen Shaku. Soyen Shaku gave a Dharma talk at the World Parliament in Religions in the 1880s. As far as we know, the first Japanese or any Asian Zen school teacher to give a talk in America. And 12 years later, he was invited to come back to America. And Soyen Shaku, the teacher of our focus this morning, wrote this poem on the boat. Like this boat on the spring ocean, a monk comes or goes by karma relations. The horizon seems to be extending endlessly. The current, however, takes us to the new world. Yesterday, the whales swam around us. Today, the clouds shut off sight of old Japan. Following in the course of Bodhidharma, from west to east, I go. Then turning south, I may visit India and Ceylon, again making the pilgrimage, like Sudana. Before long, our boat will enter the Golden Gate, and the seagulls, perhaps, will guide me to my destination. So there's a Japanese priest on the boat, 1905. He was a very innovative guy, Soyen Shaku, and our historian believes he might have been like, you know, one of the very, very few Japanese priests interested in the West. He had also gone and practiced for a while with Theravada Buddhists in Sri Lanka, which was very unusual. So anyway, he was invited back to America by a couple who he had met him when he was there in the 1880s, and they had come and visited him in Japan, Mr. and Mr. Alexander Russell of San Francisco. The Russells had visited Soyen Shaku at his temple in Gakuji during a round-the-world cruise they took. And he had permitted these Americans to join the monks in the training hall. And from these Americans who ate barley gruel with the other monks and sat a full sesshin, Soyen had learned something about how to guide foreigners in Zen. And so because of this, he was happy to accept the invitation from the Russells, which would provide him another opportunity to teach Zen to foreigners. Mr. Russell was a wealthy, civic-minded businessman with interests in mining, rubber, and real estate, and Mrs. Russell had traveled widely in the Orient, where, she once told a reporter, she had studied all religions, taking what I think is best from each. The Russells lived on the Great Coast Highway some miles from San Francisco with 7 adopted children, in the House of Silent Light, as Mrs. Russell called the house, standing on a high bluff overlooking the Pacific, surrounded by a wooden fence that sheltered a traditional Japanese garden from the wind. Entrance was gained through a Japanese-style peat gate, and over the gate the Russells had hung a wood plaque carved with Soyen Shaku's calligraphy, of the Chinese characters for silent light. Soyun Shaka's room was specially furnished in Japanese style. So this is pretty unusual in 1905, even in California. Mrs. Russell had asked Soyun Shaka to teach her family Zen, and during the 9 months that he was their guest, he did just that. "The daily life of this family is very religious," he wrote friends in Japan. "Three times a day they practice Zen meditation, sing hymns, ringing a handbell, have simple meals to the accompaniment of Western music, and the whole family, even servants, abstains from meat, wine, and smoking. And they practice meditation every day." And Mrs. Russell became the first American to begin koan studies. That's pretty interesting. The first known Westerner, or at least known American, to do koan studies in Japanese Zen was Mrs. Ida Russell of San Francisco in 1905. Most of the Japanese Zen establishment, of course, thought this was impossible for Americans and completely impossible for women, and therefore completely impossible for American women to comprehend Japanese Zen. But Soyun Shaka met their objections with a poem, which he addressed to Mrs. Russell, alluding to the famous sixth patriarch of Chinese Zen. "The fifth patriarch said, told his new monk, 'Southern monkeys have no Buddha nature.' That monk proved he had Buddha nature by becoming the sixth patriarch. In any part of the globe where there is air, fire can burn. Someday my teaching will surely go west, led by you." Soyun Shaka was joined at the Russells by a young student of his, a monk named Nyogen Sensaki. Sensaki's mother had been Japanese, his father Chinese or Russian, we don't know. He was born and immediately orphaned in Siberia, where a passing Japanese monk found him lying next to his mother's frozen body. And he was adopted by a shipwright named Sensaki, and then eventually came under care of a Soto Zen priest and Buddhist scholar who taught him Chinese classics and brought him up. He was a very scholarly young man. Supposedly by the time he was 18, he had read the whole sort of Chinese canon of Buddhism and had studied in Soto Zen and Shingon lineages. And eventually hooked up with Soyun Shaka, the first teacher in our story. Interestingly, the Japanese are so funny in some ways. Apparently Soyun Shaka never told the Russells who Nyogen Sensaki was. Just presented him as like a servant, like the houseboy. Didn't say he was an ordained Buddhist priest. And Nyogen Sensaki lived in the servants' quarters at the Russells and helped out, you know, humbly helped out. And Soyun Shaka was sent, kind of went home after 9 months. And I'm saying the story out of order, that's a little earlier. So about 9 months into their stay, I'm already realizing I better bridge this just a touch, one moment. So Sensaki in the house washed the dishes, did the laundry, cleaned the house, worked hard. But as he remembered, he was a real greenhorn. Although he knew enough English to read Carlyle's Sator Resartus, which I don't know what that is, but it must be hard to read in English. He could read that in his spare time, but he actually couldn't understand the spoken language at all. And finally, the housekeeper at the Russell's house decided she'd had enough of him. So she sent Sensaki on his way with a $5 gold piece. So the relationship with his teacher remained obscure to the Americans. And so that evening, Soyun Shaka accompanied Sensaki on his way to a Japanese hotel in San Francisco. They were walking through the Golden Gate Park when Soyun suddenly stopped, set down Senzaki's suitcase, which he had been carrying for his student, and said, "This may be far better for you. Instead of being hampered by being my attendant monk, just face the great city and see whether it conquers you or you conquered it." Then his teacher turned quickly away, said goodbye, and disappeared into the evening fog. It was the last time Senzaki ever saw him. So classic Zen story. Yeah. Big teaching. Which only would work if you were probably Japanese. You know, we would be like, wait! You know? Hold on a minute, you know. So there Senzaki is. I mean, he was interested in America. Deeply touched by Buddhism, right? Kind of a prodigy young student. But it said earlier that Nyogen Senzaki didn't really fit in with the Japanese Zen establishment either, so part of the reason he tagged along, probably. In fact, he went off and tried to start a kindergarten because he felt young little kids needed to understand something of the practice. And kindergarten was a new idea from Germany he just heard of. But now here he is in America, trying to figure out what to do. In 1910, Senzaki began in the hotel business. He started as a porter, worked his way up to clerk, eventually manager. He seemed to have gained this experience, though, without losing his innocence. And he's not talking to anybody about Buddhism, it says in here, too. Just trying to figure out what to do in America. For example, Senzaki could never understand why some customers would rent a room, stay in it for only a few hours, and then leave. Why was that? In 1916, he managed to buy a hotel with the help of a business partner. Senzaki tried, but he was not a good businessman. When the hotel lost enough money, he gave it up. And became the cook instead. And at the same time, he continued teaching Japanese and writing a little bit about Zen in Japanese newspapers. One night in November 1919, so this is 14 years since his teacher left, Senzaki woke from his sleep, shivering with cold. He lit a stick of incense and meditated until dawn. 2 days later, a newspaper arrived from Japan. Soyin Shaku had died at the age of 61, on that day. And from that time, he marked Soyin Shaku's death every year. And then in 1922, 17 years after he'd arrived in America, he dared to, quote, utter the bee of Buddhism to Americans. He hired a hall with $20 that he'd saved up from working as a houseboy and gave his first lecture. In that lecture, he translated a talk that Soyin Shaku had given earlier called First Steps in Meditation. But his English was so heavily accented that he had to write almost all the words down on a blackboard. At the end of the lecture, he asked people to leave their names and addresses. From then on, he would hire a hall whenever he had enough money. Sometimes he would simply speak on Buddhism in a friend's parlor. He called these various meeting places his floating zendo. The only image present was a 600-year-old painting of Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of Wisdom, whose figure sits on the altar in Zen meditation halls. He had it on loan from an art dealer. In 1927, a brother monk by the name of Maiyama visited San Francisco for 3 days. When he returned to Japan, he helped out by raising $300 for the floating zendo. Within a month, Senzaki had enough money to hire a hall and buy chairs for people to sit on. He'd now established a zendo, one that he could carry as a silkworm hides himself in his cocoon for 30 more years. And in 1931, Senzaki moved his floating zendo to Los Angeles. The money for his move to Turner Street, where he held his meetings, came from the Japanese community, and Senzaki kept up the practice he'd started in San Francisco of instructing Japanese on one night and Americans on another. Senzaki had followed Soyin Shaku's advice during his years in San Francisco. He had met the challenge of the city head on. He'd immersed himself in the world, even while he studied and practiced and prepared himself to teach Buddhism. Now in Los Angeles, it was Senzaki the monk that appeared once again. Quote, a Buddhist monk is celibate and leads the simplest life possible, he wrote a friend sometime later. He never charges for any kind of work he does, being only grateful to do something for his fellow men. He accepts used clothes or old shoes and wears them. Any excess of food or money, he gives it away. He sleeps quietly without worries. Having nothing in his possession, he has nothing to fear. It was not easy to help Senzaki, since he would give everything away. Anything he did not immediately need. A favorite ploy among his students was to leave a $5 bill inside the meditation bell, hoping he wouldn't find it at first. But when Sasaki did find it, he'd immediately invite that person who had left it to join him for dinner in a nearby cafe. Sasaki didn't need much, but he knew how to enjoy himself. The Zendo in Los Angeles had two names, the Mentor Garden Meditation Hall, Mentor Garden like kindergarten, and Tozen Zenkutsu, Meditation Hall for the Eastern Dharma in Japanese. He didn't try to teach his students the traditional cross-legged posture. They sat in chairs for an hour's meditation once a week, heard a short lecture from Senzaki, chanted the four bodhisattva vows, and left. There was no socializing. Everyone left in silence except for those who stayed behind to speak to Senzaki privately. There was no statue of Buddha, just the painting. Senzaki recited sutras three times a day, but I do not mean to pray to this bodhisattva, reassured the students. A true Mahayana never worships anything but our true self. The recitation is expression of our wisdom and nothing else. So he was doing this on his own, wasn't really interacting with the Japanese Buddhist establishment, which they didn't like too much, but it seemed natural enough to him in California. And it goes on, he taught Zen because it felt it approached the true meaning of Buddhism most directly. So he wasn't exactly sectarian either, trying to plant Zen. He just thought Zen was a good path for the moment. And he remained removed from sectarian squabbles that had become endemic among Japanese Buddhists. Once a year, he led his students and friends on a Buddhist pilgrimage of Los Angeles, where by now, in 1938, there were Zen temples, a Shin temple, a Jodo temple, a Nichiren temple, and a Shingon temple, all serving the Japanese community of Los Angeles. Which is an important side note, that most of these histories written by convert Buddhists tend to focus on the interaction between convert Buddhists like us and Asian teachers. Of course, there was also a lot going in the Japanese immigrant community. When Sasaki visited these temples, he visited each one, offered incense, and recited a poem. Sometimes the priest also gave a short talk. Senzaki's main supporter in Los Angeles was a Mrs. Kin Tanahashi, proprietor of a Japanese bakery. In the fall of 1934, Mrs. Tanahashi was reading a Japanese magazine, Fujin Koran, and she came across some poems and diary entries from another young Japanese Zen monk named Nakagawa Soen. Mrs. Tanahashi showed Soen's work to Senzaki, and the two men began a correspondence. Like Senzaki, Soen was disillusioned with the Japanese Zen establishment and was living by himself on a mountain he called Daibosatsu Mountain, Great Bodhisattva Mountain, practicing Zazen, eating wild plants, and making prostrations to the sun as it rose every day. That was his practice, this other guy named Soen. Senzaki had gone his own way in this strange land, as he called America, for 30 years when he began this correspondence with Nakagawa Soen. But now at last he had found someone who understood his rather unorthodox approach. Perhaps this Soen would one day be able to continue his work. Because remember, this is 30 years in, and Senzaki has like no students exactly, some Americans who come once a week, some friends in the Japanese community. You know, he's middle-aged now. Nobody actually really knows when he was born, so maybe he's late 40s, early 50s now. So how's it all going to work out, right? So effort, continuous effort. This continued on until 1943. The war had started in Executive Order 9066, caused 110,000 Japanese-American citizens and non-citizens alike, infants and grandparents, to be removed to internment camps, surrounded by barbed wire, watchtowers, and armed guards. Nyogen Senzaki was sent to Heart Mountain, a camp in the desert of Wyoming with 10,000 others. Perhaps he thought the relocation could be seen as another example of the eastward movement of his teachings. And he seemed to accept it. He wrote, a government must practice its policies without sentiment. He wrote a poem. All Japanese faces will leave California to support their government. This morning, the winding train, like a big black snake, takes us away as far as Wyoming. The current of Buddhism always runs east. The policy may support the tendency of the teaching. Who knows? So we can make our own judgments there, right? Incredibly accepting, compliant. Yeah, I guess he knew he couldn't fight it. But it was a time of great uncertainty. Before leaving Los Angeles, Senzaki had entrusted his robes to an American student, since he couldn't tell when, if ever, he might return. But he carried his floating Zendo with him and established a sitting place in the small cabin that he shared with a man, a wife, and their small child. And 10 to 12 people would join him for the same meetings that he'd been carrying on all along. These are the happiest and most contented evacuees in the center, he wrote to the 20 or 30 American students with whom he continued to correspond in Los Angeles. And he managed to send them a lecture every month so they could continue studying. The young monk, remember the guy in the mountain eating plants, Nakagawa Soan, had planned to visit Senzaki. They had it all planned for to meet in Los Angeles in 1941. But with the war, that was impossible. So the two men, who had never met in person, agreed to face each other across the ocean at a certain time on the 25th of every month, Daibosatsu Day, and bow to each other in greeting. It would take more than a war to keep them apart. In July 1945, the Supreme Court ruled against the internment of Japanese Americans. More than 40,000 had already been relocated to places like Colorado, Illinois, and Utah, and those who returned to the West Coast found the neighborhoods they lived in filled with new immigrants from the South and Mexico. To anyone who cared to see, it was clear that the Nisei and Issei, first and second and third generations, had demonstrated their loyalty in the war, and yet their farms had been abandoned, their orchards had died, many of their possessions had been stolen. The Nichiren Temple in Los Angeles, where more than 600 families had stored their belongings, had been looted, and all was lost. So Senzaki returned to Los Angeles and took up residence again at the homes of various students, once again homeless, just as he had been when Soyen Shaku, a teacher, had walked away from him in Golden Gate Park in 1905. In October 1945, he marked the anniversary of his teacher's death, as he had done every year, with a poem. For 40 years, I have not seen my teacher, Soyen Shaku, in person. But I have carried his Zen in my empty fist, wandering ever since in this strange land. Being a mere returnee from the evacuation, I could establish no Zendo where his followers could commemorate the 26th anniversary of his death. The cold rain purifies everything on the earth. I, in the great city of Los Angeles today, open my fist and spread the fingers at a street corner in the evening rush hour. I'm sure they had their grumpy days, but mythic lives are what are left for us. Soon after his return, he had settled into a small corner apartment on the top floor of the Miyaku Hotel in the heart of Little Tokyo. And it was here, with the sounds of traffic floating up from the streets below, that Senzaki once again set up secondhand chairs acquired from a funeral parlor for the meetings of the post-war Zendo. On Sundays, a fairly substantial Japanese congregation chanted sutras. During the week, the English-speaking meeting continued as they had for the last 25 years. People meditating in wooden chairs, Senzaki marking off the periods with wooden clappers, reciting the four vows, listening to a short talk or reading from one of the translations he was working on. Then tea, along with the Japanese confection, and the meeting would be over. As before, socializing was discouraged. If Senzaki found people lingering too long after a meeting, he would pointedly suggest it was probably time to go home. The most important event of these post-war years, as far as Senzaki was concerned, was at last the arrival of Nakagawa Soan in 1949. The two men who corresponded for 15 years and bowed across the ocean to each other every month during the war at last met face to face on San Francisco's Pier 42. And they continued teaching together for a while. Then in the early 50s, one of Sasaki's most devoted students was a young man, a young American named Robert Aiken. Like Senzaki, Aiken had spent the war years in internment, in his case on the opposite side, in internment in Japan, where he was introduced by Zen to Zen through a chance encounter with a translator and poet named R.H. Blythe. And upon his release, Aiken returned to Hawaii, where he grew up, finished his B.A. in English Literature, and wrote a really fantastic senior thesis that became a book about haiku. You should find it if you don't have it. Married and spent a semester studying Japanese language and literature in Berkeley, and began seeking a teacher. In the Christmas vacation of 1947, Aiken and a friend took a trip south to Ojai, where they hoped to find the Indian teacher, you know, Indian teacher, Krishnamurti, who Aiken thought would be about as close as I could get to Zen in this country. But Krishnamurti was away in India at the time, so Aiken and his friend continued south. At Ione Perkins Bookstore in Pasadena, they found Richard Gard working as a chief clerk while working for his doctorate in Buddhist studies at Claremont College. Gard and Aiken had known each other at the University of Hawaii before the war, and so Gard told Aiken about Nyogen Senzaki. So Aiken went immediately to the Miyako Hotel in Little Tokyo and knocked on Senzaki's door. You know, no internet, right? Doubtful that there was even a phone in his room. He found Senzaki alone in his room, and Senzaki showed Aiken a photograph of Nakagawa Soan, and Aiken asked Senzaki if the purpose of Zazen was self-realization. Senzaki says it was. By the time the visit was over, Aiken had decided that this was what he wanted to do. So he returned to Northern California returned for his wife. This was written by a man, right? Returned to try to convince his wife, I guess, to move to L.A. so he could study with Senzaki Roshi, which he did for many years. And various things happened, so on, continuing to teach, so on, going back and forth to Japan. Senzaki only went back to Japan once all these years. And Senzaki encouraging Robert Aiken to go to Japan, which he did, and had various adventures. And then we'll end our story with the last year of Senzaki's life. Oh yeah, which is when he returned to Japan. In 1955, Nyogen Senzaki returned to Japan for the first and last time. Senzaki visited Soyin Shaku's grave at Kamakura, but he stayed mostly at Rutakuji, a temple, avoiding the Rinzai Zen establishment in Kyoto. As stubborn and independent as Japan as he had been all these years in America, it had been nearly half a century since Senzaki had left Japan for San Francisco with Soyin Shaku. And though he had grown used to American ways, he never lost his emotional tie to his homeland. The monks at Ryutakuji were curious about their Roshi's friend from America. And then various monks met him who ended up teaching in America too. And through Senzaki's close association with Soen Roshi, a number of Americans began to study in Japan. Robert Aiken, Philip Kaplow, Gary Snyder, a number of others. But Senzaki was growing old, and so said Soan, and he needed an attendant. So Soan asked one of these young monks if he would return to America with Senzaki for about a year. He was named Tai Shimano, and he ended up being another important teacher in America. And then, in May 1958, a telephone call came during morning Zazen. Soen Roshi left his seat to answer in Japan and did not return. And after morning Zazen, Soen told the monks that Senzaki had died that morning. They knelt and chanted the four vows together. Senzaki's last rites, like his life, were conducted his own way. His body was laid out in a mortuary filled with flowers. 12 Japanese priests chanted and placed a memorial tablet on the shrine that had been set up for the occasion. That much was conventional. Then someone announced that a talk by Senzaki would be played. A record table had been set up on a piano, and from it the mourners were quite startled to hear Senzaki's voice, loud and clear, first in Japanese, quite cheerful, talking and laughing, and then in English. And then a woman read Senzaki's last words, a statement that he had written in 1936 and revised many times. And during the reading, Senzaki could be heard correcting the reader's pronunciation. So he got somebody to read it in English and recorded it. Clearly knew exactly what he wanted to say. I imagine I was going away from this world, leaving all of you behind, and I wrote my last words in English, friends in the Dharma, to be satisfied. I wrote these last words, friends in the Dharma, in English. Please be satisfied with your own heads. Do not put any false heads above your own. Then minute after minute, watch your step closely. These are my last words to you. He went on, as he said, he felt he owed some explanation. Each head of yours is the noblest thing in the universe. No god, no Buddha, no sage, no master can reign over it. Rinzai said, if you master your own situation, wherever you stand is the land of truth. How many of our fellow beings can prove the truthfulness of this word, of these words, by their actions? Keep your head cool and your feet warm. Do not let sentiments sweep your feet. Well-trained Zen students should breathe with their feet, not with their lungs. Breathe with their feet. This means you should forget your lungs and only be conscious with your feet while breathing. The head is the sacred part of the body. Let it do its own work, but do not make any monkey business. Remember me as a monk, nothing else. I do not belong to any sect or any cathedral. None of them should send me a promoted priest rank or anything of that sort, like after his death. I would like to be free from such trash and die happily. And people lined up to offer incense. The halls, the side rooms, every stitch of place was filled with people, a student later wrote. People of all kinds and descriptions, races and creeds. That, to me, was really the tribute. Senzaki's ashes were placed in the Japanese cemetery in East Los Angeles within the site of his stone, so the memorial for the graves of the soldiers of the 442nd Nisei Combat Battalion. Soan's calligraphy of Senzaki's name was carved into the face of the stone, and on the back, in English, was Senzaki's admonition, keep your head cool and your feet warm. Soan Roshi had been present at Senzaki's funeral, and afterward, he led two memorial sesshins. Robert Aiken, who served as his jisha, attendant for the first sesshin, where Soan Roshi doubled as the jikijitsu, like the timekeeper and the Eno together, Aiken believed this to have been the first time ever a full 7-day Zen Sesshin in America had been conducted in the traditional manner, although it was still somewhat irregular. Everyone found it very difficult, he remembers. Everyone was very unaccustomed to this regime. It was really hard to not talk and keep our minds centered, and our legs really hurt. So that, in a way, was Senzaki Roshi's last action. And his death led to the first formal Japanese sesshin we know of in America. And this is just one of many stories with this kind of flavor, you know. Incredible patience, great effort and persistence, lots of humility, a little orneriness, you know, a lot of skillfulness. And I was just thinking, realizing when I first heard this story years ago, I wasn't actually as impressed with it then as I am now. You know, like they just sat in chairs and listened to a little lecture. You know, that was the whole thing. So as a young proto-monk myself, I was a little dismissive. But now I get it, I think, a little better. How amazing that actually was. That a Japanese Zen priest tossed into this young, you know, some intensive training in his early years, but not near as much training as most of us are going to get, trying to offer this in a way with integrity, a way that would fit, a way that would work. And the way he, and a Japanese Zen priest, without making any big bones about it, quietly trying to find a way to support himself in a foreign country without good language, just quietly offering Zazen, quietly offering teachings, and offering silence, offering the practice of silence. I never noticed that before either, which is such a powerful part of what we're doing this weekend. But it's a hard practice, you know, you have to practice it for a while to appreciate it, and then you realize what a deep and important practice silence is. But we could never offer the practice of silence, especially in the middle of a busy downtown American town, unless a bunch of us had already really steeped in that, right? We have a whole community container which makes silence practice possible. He didn't have any of that. He just discouraged them from chatting, you know, encouraged a certain kind of settledness, a certain kind of quiet, as befitting and appropriate the practice of Dharma. And then Nyogen Sensaki's work led directly, somehow, to his younger monk friend, Soen Roshi, offering this first formal sesshin in America as a memorial. Then in a way, Nyogen Sensaki literally gave his life to create the conditions that allowed this to happen. So what kind of effort is this, you know? What is the basis of this kind of long-haul effort, long-form effort? It sure can't just be getting what you want, you know? Getting it your way or something. And it can't be trying too hard, and it can't be goofing off either, right? Somehow, he had a steadiness. Kept at it week after week. There was enough money to hire a hall. There's enough support to have an apartment with enough room, practice there. So what's the basis of that kind of effort? Is it vow? Is the basic a vow? We don't have recorded that he particularly took a vow, an explicit vow. The chapter of the book, and this is from Rick Field's kind of seminal study of Buddhism coming to a convert, you know, America, called How the Swans Came to the Lake. The chapter of the book that this is in, Rick Fields calls holding the lotus to the rock, you know, holding the lotus to the rock. So you got to be pretty patient, you know. It's not going to root right away. Suzuki Roshi in our lineage says our way of practice is to have no gaining ideas. Just offering something. Just accepting whatever comes back from the universe. Being smart, for sure, but keeping at it. So is there a way we can be inspired by these stories to train ourselves, to pay attention ourselves to what our quality of effort is? Can we have an effort based on gratitude, based on vow? An effort that's quite a bit softer about results, about getting it the way we want it. Just making an offering. And we can always learn about this from the opening to it, from how lovely it feels when our effort is in harmony, when our effort is easeful. And we can learn about this from the opposite too, tough lessons for sure, but so important. When we feel tight, when we feel upset, when it's not what we want, when it's not working. Can we return to our intention those times? Can we be interested in the pain, the anger, the tightness? Can we be grateful for that too, as part of our path? As we do our best to live out our vow, to be mature beings, to be open beings, devoted to serving and supporting this world, this suffering world, with its shootings, with its growth, with the all of it. So thank you, Nyogen Sensaki Roshi. Thank you to all of our ancestors. Thank you to everybody here. Let's just continue as best we can. thank you for your patience also with a longer talk.